From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Oh, I escaped the frigid temperatures of St. Louis. It was about 2 degrees when I got on the plane at Lambert International Airport this morning, heading for Los Angeles, where it's been about 70 today. I did okay. Elvis Presley would have been 75 today. Happy birthday to the king. And open lines later tonight with a Monster in a Closet hotline. So get ready for that. Here's what's happening. Well, with the U.S. economy showing signs still of continued weakness, and with the country still reeling in the wake of the Fort Hood disaster, you remember that, and the botched Christmas Day airline attack, economists are raising concerns that a third strike, another terror attack in the U.S., could deal a crippling blow to the nation's economic recovery. John Curtis is the editor of the online columnist.com. John, this situation, of course, would be extremely tenable for us if something did happen. But I'm a little concerned. I mean, this is a story that's going all around the country now. Are they letting terrorists know, hey, one more hit and we're in trouble?
Well, I think what they're really trying to do is, get our defenses up right now. I think there's no question that the situation is very tenuous. And if we were struck, I think it would be a very punishing blow to the economy, which is reeling right now. I mean, the Federal Reserve Board has dropped their monetary policy, lowered interest rates to 0 to 0.25%. And this has been going on for like a year and a half, and it still hasn't been enough stimulus. There's been two stimulus bills totaling trillions of dollars, and it still hasn't, $1.5 trillion, and it still hasn't brought the economy back to life. I think people are very concerned about it.
So what happens? What happens in the next few months? We let our guard down a little bit on that plane situation. The president's taking blame for that.
Well, I think that the problem with the president right now is that he's really caught between the rock and the hard place. It's the old military guard that really forced his hand to put the 30,000 troops in Afghanistan when the new battlefront that's emerged in Yemen and certainly in parts of Pakistan along the border is where the U.S. should be focusing its energy.
All right. Very good. Thanks, John. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. Umar Farouk Abdul Botalad, the man charged with trying to blow up that Northwestern Airlines plane on December 25th, has now pleaded not guilty to 6 federal charges. Asked by a magistrate judge whether he was taking any medication, he replied that he was taking painkillers, but that he understood the 6 charges he faced. United Parcel Service, you know it as UPS, will cut 1,800 jobs as it trims its domestic management structure. Foot Locker has announced that it will close 117 stores and eliminate about 120 jobs by the end of January. You know, we've been talking about these traffic lights that catch you speeding. California drivers could get stuck with speeding tickets even with not a cop in sight under a proposal tucked deep into the budget of the governor. The Republican governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, wants to let cities and counties install speed sensors and red light cameras to ticket speeding drivers. Those whizzing by the detectors up to 15 miles per hour above the limit would have to fork over $225 per violation. Those going faster than that would pay $325 under the plan. Red light cameras already exist in communities across the state. They think that this would net California about $337 million. We'll see. Arizona's been trying it. It's not working for them. They're seriously thinking of just dropping the whole thing. You know, on my anniversary on last Sunday, 7-year anniversary on Coast to Coast, Jim Berklin, our geologist who came on to talk a little bit about the 7 years, also talked about sea lions in the Bay Area. They were all gone. Where did they go? Nobody knew. Well, we now know where they went. They went 500 miles north up to the Oregon coast. The big question is, why? Is this a barometer? Do they know that there could be an earthquake in the Bay Area, so they left? We're going to monitor that situation. Avatar, the movie, is on course to become the highest-grossing film of all time. making $1.14 billion since its release less than 3 weeks ago. It's already overtaken The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King, and it is approaching Titanic's $1.84 billion. So we'll see what happens. Up next, we're going to be talking with two incredible people. I'll tell you about that in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Two guests for you now. Michael Harrison is the founder, publisher, editor of Talkers Magazine, the leading trade publication in the industries of talk radio, talk television, talk internet, and talk satellite. He is a seasoned broadcaster, 43 years experience as a radio talent, programmer, station owner, producer, trade magazine publisher, and is considered to be one of the nation's leading experts on radio, television, media, and popular culture as it is reflected in these media. As a matter of fact, I know for one, I look at this magazine all the time just to find out what's going on. Here is, first of all, Michael Harrison. Michael, how are you?
I'm fine, George. It's great to be with you. What a great show and what a great job you've done. Happy anniversary and congratulations.
Thank you, Michael. And of course, Andrian is the widow of the late astronomer Carl Sagan. She is an author, lecturer, television and motion picture writer-producer whose work is largely concerned with the effects of science and technology on all of us. She was the co-writer with Sagan of the Emmy and Peabody Award-winning television series Cosmos. Miss Drianne is the founder and CEO of Cosmos Studios, producing science-based entertainment for all media. It's a special reason that they're both here tonight. Here's Anne. Anne, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks, George. Thanks so much for having me on.
My pleasure. You know, and I've never had this opportunity, Anne, to talk with you, but I just, as someone who has been in this business for as long as I have never been more influenced as I have been with your late husband.
Really?
He just had a way of presenting science where it was just so exciting. He captivated me, and I'm sure he captivated so many others.
Well, I'm just delighted to hear you say that. Thank you so much.
Michael, he had a gift, didn't he?
Oh, he was amazing. First of all, he was an excellent scientist and a brilliant astronomer, and I that's always been my hobby and my non-professional interest. But he also was a media genius in terms of being able to take something that is very academic, esoteric, complex, bringing it down to layman terms, being the go-to guy, and creating marvelous entertainment that was at the same time extremely educational. And I think there were thousands, who knows, hundreds of thousands of young scientists today, or even not that young at this point, because the years have been going by, who are in that profession because they were influenced to be that by Carl Sagan.
Absolutely. And Michael and Anne, I can't tell you how many times I practiced saying billions and billions over the years. He was able to utilize that phrase and basically turned it into a household phrase, wasn't he, Anne?
Yes, well, actually, it was Johnny Carson, of course, who really coined that phrase when he did his imitation of Carl. And Carl always said that he'd never really said it, but he embraced it because he had a great sense of humor and because he knew that it was a code word for the fact that he was talking about the vastness of the universe on a scale that is counterintuitive and beyond any experience that we have here on Earth.
And I have heard, but I've never been able to confirm it, that Carl truly believed in extraterrestrial life, just didn't believe that they were visiting this planet. I'm sure he talked a lot with you about that because you both worked on the book Contact, for example, and the picture.
It was one of our favorite subjects, and I think what you're saying is basically correct, but I would quibble with the use of the word believed. He withheld belief in the absence of evidence because he was truly a devout scientist.
Yeah.
But yes, of course, you're right, George. He felt that with the vastness of the universe, with the presence of organic molecules, the building blocks of life everywhere you looked, that it was very unlikely that the only place in this vast cosmos where life had evolved was here. It just didn't seem right, but of course, no direct evidence.
Michael, you know what it takes to make a good communicator. You're one yourself, and you've watched and monitored every talk show host in the country, radio, television. Carl Sagan had this special gift, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was one of the best communicators of our time. And we've never seen the likes of him again. And I've talked with Anne about this, that what the world needs is another Carl Sagan, a go-to guy, someone to explain what's going on in the world of science. Because as science is evolving, and you know this because you walk along the border with this program between the science and the known and the unknown, as science is progressing into the 21st century, truth is becoming stranger than fiction. It's as if the science fiction writers can't keep up with the physicists. And if Carl Sagan were alive today, or if we had somebody like Carl Sagan to explain it from the scientific perspective the way he did, the world would be a smarter place.
And tell me a little bit about what it was like to work with Carl on Contact, one of my favorite movies in a great book.
Well, it was a feast of ideas. We worked together for 20 years. We were inseparable. We had two children together. And so there was no dividing line between work and family and fun. Of course, we were working on some of the most interesting, intriguing questions of all. And so it was just a complete joy to work with Carl. You know, I think one of the secrets of his talent to communicate was that he was in love. He was in love with nature and reality. He was in love with the world, the universe revealed by science. And that love, that sense of being in love, was infectious, and he communicated. And the project that Michael and I have done together at Home in the Cosmos with Annie Drian is a kind of a visit to my home to hear 3.5 hours of the stories of what it was like to make contact, Cosmos, to create the Voyager interstellar message, to live with Carl. It's a kind of... knowing what the man was inside and outside. And that was the great thing about him, is that person that you admired from a distance, who was so communicative and so open, was the person he was inside. There was no gap between his presentation of self to the world and the way he conducted himself.
Well, we lost him way too early, 62 years old.
Yeah.
He died of pneumonia, but it was complications from bone marrow transplants?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes, George, exactly. He mounted a valiant battle for his life for 2 years. He had 3 bone marrow transplants during that time. During that time, he wrote 2 books. And the transplant doctors said that they actually hadn't had any patients who had actually finished reading a book during the course of a transplant because it was such an ordeal. Carl wrote The Demon-Haunted World and Billions during those 2 years. And, he faced his death with a kind of courage that inspires me to this day. He was unflinching, always looking forward. And he loved life so much that he really fought valiantly.
Well, I'm glad we're able to keep alive his memory with his works and your work, and as well, and with this 39 video podcast set, as you just mentioned, at Home in the Cosmos with Anne Drian. Michael, tell me a little bit about your involvement with this and your interest here.
Well, certainly, as I mentioned earlier, I have always been, since I'm a kid, fascinated with astronomy, and I'm, the world's greatest media freak. Put it together, and you have a Carl Sagan fan. I always had a fascination for Carl Sagan, loved what he did, never had the opportunity to meet him, and of course have mourned for years that he's no longer with us. As I'm watching the development of media, I'm realizing that the internet provides opportunity to do unlimited programming. And I find, aside from programs like yours, that most of my interest in science or my interest in stories about science are not really satisfied by watching the Science Channel or the Discovery mm-hmm. Channels or public television. Everything is compacted into the same story between commercial breaks, very limited. I figured, what would it be like to be able to just do hours and hours on any topic, let alone one I'm interested in, and put it on the internet? So I contacted Andrian, who is about as close to Carl Sagan as you can get. Remember,
yeah.
She collaborated on most of his major projects. And she loved the idea. We got to know each other over a year talking about it. And then we brought our camera crew into her home. And it's not an interview. It's Anne talking to the camera in different rooms of her house, around the grounds, the archives, talking to the camera as if you were sitting across the table from her, having dinner with her, lunch with her, in her living room, in the backyard, even at the graveside of Carl Sagan. And the most intimate details about his work, about their life together, and the storybook romance they had. And bringing it back to your question, why me? Because I love where the media is going, and this was for me a labor of love, not only the subject matter, but the idea that a podcast, or in this case, 39 video podcasts put together like an old rock and roll concept album, can be put out there from producers direct to the consumers without any middlemen, without any censors, without any editors, and without any kind of commercial restraint. So it's just a wonderful project on so many levels.
Anne, were you happy with your performance?
Actually, I'm proud of the fact that I think there were virtually everything was a single take. You know, it was from the heart.
I don't even do that, Anne.
Yeah, isn't that true, Michael? I mean,
the thing about you, Anne, that is so wonderful, and I have to tell everybody because it's almost shocking, and I imagine Carl was the same way, that you speak off the top of your head as if it were being written and edited.
Thank you.
We were prepared to do hours and hours and hours of editing and putting things together. It wasn't necessary. You could take, and this was spontaneous. This was not a scripted production. You could take a transcript of what Anne was talking about, print it, and it would be a marvelous book that would need very little editing. The woman is an articulate wonder. And I don't know, maybe you're rubbed off on each other over those 20 years, Anne.
Well, I think we did learn a lot from each other. It was, being together, we became much more than the sum of our parts. There was a complementarity there that was amazing. And just a kind of a oneness. And so I always felt like we were like sea mammals, moving. Ever seen like sea mammals moving together on the hull of a ship, and then all of a sudden one of them, they'll peel off and they move as if they've spoken to each other.
Yeah.
They're moving so fast.
Yeah, they're in harmony with
they're
each other.
They're in total harmony. Yeah. And that's what it felt like being with Carl. It was just, God, it was so interesting. And of course, the greatest thing was that there wasn't a single question that would occur to me that I couldn't turn to him and ask. And, it was in the days before Google and Wikipedia, it was really like living with someone who had that entire Wikipedia global network in their brain. He was very learned and loved to explain things, as we all know.
And did you ever, after, let's say, an event, a speaking event, or Carl was on a television show, did you ever pull him aside and critique him?
Oh, yeah, of course. He loved that.
Good.
And, there was no, he would laugh so hard. I mean, yes, he was open to that. And, it was, he was so secure. He was so fully realized as a person. He was so at home in himself and in the cosmos that he could take it and learn and teach.
Was he baffled by the cosmos? Just the awe of it?
Yes, and that's what I think you just hit exactly what the secret of his greatness was, is that he was in equal measures filled with both skepticism and wonder, not one at the expense of the other. He wanted to be skeptical because he didn't want to just believe what he wanted to believe. He wanted to know, and so he was skeptical, but equally filled with wonder. So he wasn't one of those closed-minded people who have no sense of the great romance of life. And it was that skepticism and wonder together. It's such a potent force because it's imagination and critical thinking that gets you to the stars.
Well, we've got a website for you, Anne. It's called podjockey.com, and it's linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. It's a set of 39 video podcasts that run a total of more than 3.5 hours featuring Anne in her home in Ithaca, New York, sharing the 20 years that she spent with Carl Sagan. We'll be back with more with Anne and Michael. We'll talk about the life of Carl Sagan, and we'll also take some of your phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. In a moment, we'll take your phone calls and continue our discussion with Michael Harrison and Andrean as we talk about their work on these 39 video podcasts featuring Anne as we talk about and she shares her 20 years with Carl Sagan. That's all next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie, and tonight we're with Andrean. She is the wife of the late Carl Sagan and Michael Harrison, publisher and editor of Talkers Magazine. And we're talking about their work of the video podcast that they've put together. And were you happy with the way the movie Contact finally came out, which was based on your novel?
Well, it took 17 years, George, from the time Carl and I wrote the 110-page original treatment for the movie. And so I was just happy that it got made to begin with. But also, there are many things about Contact that I'm very proud of. I think Jodie Foster's performance is magnificent.
Yes.
I think that that opening scene, which I remember Carl dictating into a little handheld tape recorder many years before, of the message traveling across the cosmos, and that series of removes that gives you some sense of the scale of the universe, I thought was absolutely magnificent. And I think Bob Zemeckis did a fine job, and I'm overall tremendously proud of it.
You know, Michael, it is and will always be one of my favorite movies. It just had a great message behind it.
Oh, no question. I mean, we all, you know, wonder, is there a signal out there? Is there a life out there? The whole SETI thing. As we get smarter about science, it becomes more unlikely that we're alone than there's life out there. Although, whether or not they're flying saucers and people are seeing UFOs and we're being visited or abducted, you know, that's arguable. But on a scientific level, I mean, look at the size of the universe and look at the ubiquitousness of the elements that make life, let alone we're finding water. And we're seeing out further and further. It may not be long before we get that signal. And can you imagine? I mean, that was a movie. That was a depiction of what might be the future. Can you imagine when that day comes? I hope it's within our lifetimes.
I'm really sorry that Carl didn't get to see that. That's one of the billions and billions of sadnesses about Carl's passing at such a young age. Another thing I'd like to say about Contact is that I think it dealt with the tension between religion and science in a way that was constructive. And it wasn't, you know, it was meant to be a kind of resolution in our hearts about those feelings, that longing to be connected to the universe and to understand how it came to be, and to do it not in a, you know, in a way that where science annihilates those feelings, but in a way that those feelings can somehow reside in the same heart.
One of my favorite quotes, the alien was talking to Ellie, saying, "You're an interesting species, an interesting mix. You're capable of such beautiful dreams and such horrible nightmares. You feel so lost, so cut off, so alone, only you're not. See, in our searching, the only thing we found that makes the emptiness bearable is each other." God, I still get chills, Anne, when I read that.
Thank you. And I look back on the times that Carl and I spent writing those words as having been part of something sacred, you know, sacred in the sense that it was a striving for truth, and it was filled with love. And I think the feelings that we had for each other informed everything we did, from the Voyager interstellar record through the Cosmos television series and Contact itself. That feeling of in the vastness, the amazing thing of being conscious in a 13.5 billion year period. How long do we live? 100 years. The idea that we have a chance to connect with each other in the vastness of space and the immensity of time. is something so endlessly inspiring.
It sure is. Sure is. In the time that we have remaining here, we'll take some phone calls. Michael, though, if people are interested in the podcasts, the 39 video podcasts, do they just go to that website, podjockey.com?
Yeah. They can either go right now to your homepage and link to it, or go to www.podjockey.com. And on the homepage of Podjockey is a large graphic, and it's a picture of Carl and Anne holding hands, walking through the stars. It's a beautiful graphic, and you just press enter, and it tells you what to do.
Super. Let's pick it up by going to O'Fallon, Illinois, on the wild card line. James, how cold is it out there, James?
Oh, it's 3 degrees.
A heat wave in Illinois. Yeah. Go ahead, James.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask the two guests, rather anyone who wants to answer would be fine. I personally have seen, like, so many UFOs that it makes me sick when I would try to describe just one of the events to somebody, because they just look at me like I'm crazy. So, and then to mention, you know, I've seen about 30 of them, you know, half of which I believe were totally unmanned made. I just want to ask either one of the guests, there's a place in the highlands of Chile called Puma Punku, and they have what appears to be the hardest granite that appears to have been machined. And the only rock harder is diamond. And I wanted to ask you, what do you think of that, and my personal beliefs in that we've already had contact?
Okay, and I'm sure you and Carl talked for hours about how the pyramids were built.
Yes.
And some of the other magnificent structures on this
yes.
planet.
Yes, and I know what the caller is talking about, and yet there are very simple explanations for how humans were able to achieve these wonders of the world. Our ancestors were just as smart as we are, and they had much less to work with. Their technology was much more simple, of course, but they were ingenious. And I don't think there's any mystery as to how the pyramids were actually constructed. Are they amazing? I've seen them, yes. The size of each of those individual stones is really, it's counterintuitive that humans could do it, but we could do it, just like we can now do buildings that are 2,200 feet tall. That's something that we're good at, and really we don't have to go to a extraterrestrial explanation in order to understand how these great edifices were built.
You know, Michael, you've seen it all in this business. Isn't it exciting how this field that we're all in, that we love so much, continues to evolve, where you can do these different projects like these video podcasts? Heck, 10 or 15 years ago, nobody would even have known what that was.
Exactly. And I got to tell you, I feel like I'm a pioneer at this point, because many, many people still don't know what it is.
That's true.
So we're all still on the frontier of a very exciting period. I do believe, George, that the Internet is going to change humanity on a level that we've never seen technologically in our history. It's going to be like fire or the wheel. I think that the Internet is going to, as the decades go by, change the actual intellectual level of the species. The human race is going to become a smarter, more intelligent species exponentially, because of our sudden ability to access all the information that there ever was, down to each individual, and be in touch with each other instantaneously. It's almost as if we're becoming telepathic.
Yes.
Think about it.
Absolutely. I'm thinking, Michael, of having my network develop some kind of hologram where I can literally beam myself into everybody's house and walk around while I'm doing the show.
Yeah, huh? Yeah.
That's not outrageous at all.
It may happen.
Of course.
I think what you said was so very perceptive, especially because I think it will change the nature of education, because it won't be the idea of memorizing these facts will no longer be of any importance, because everyone will have instantaneous access to them.
Mm-hmm.
It's the ability to synthesize this information, that how to evaluate whether things are true. These are the things that we really have to teach to future generations, and I think that the Internet makes that possible.
Let's go to Larry in Temecula, California. First-time caller. Larry, thanks for calling.
Hi, George. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
very interested in your show and the guests that you have on. And I'm a 52-year-old man, and I've been in the mortgage business for 20 years here in California, and I don't have to tell you what things have changed.
You've seen it all, too.
Absolutely. And one thing I wanted to mention, you know, I like to think I'm a worldly person, and, you know, I've been to college, and, you know, the things about Carl Sagan that I know, I found out pretty much by accident. But the reason for my call was I wanted to ask if maybe you could point out that video, the pale blue dot. I think if more people around the world would look that up on the Internet, the pale blue dot, I think there would be more world peace, because when you think about what the message says, it's just, it's really inspiring. And I think for the new generation of people who may not be familiar with Carl and his work, I think you could even use that as an intro to your show occasionally, or in between, maybe use it as some music.
All right. What do you think of that, Ann?
I think it's a wonderful idea. I'm really, really happy that the caller brought up Pale Blue Dot, because, you know, this was when the Voyager spacecraft were leaving the solar system. They were out by Neptune. Carl had worked for 10 years to convince NASA to turn the pictures back to Earth and to look at the planet in the context of the solar system, to take a picture, not the Apollo frame-filling Earth, which was, also a big game changer in terms of the civilization, but now to see the Earth as a one-pixel dot. And NASA was resistant because the cameras could burn out facing the sun. But after 10 years, he managed to persuade them. And so on Valentine's Day, out by Neptune, there is this image of the Earth. And Carl wrote, I think, maybe one of the most beautiful paragraphs that he ever wrote. And he wrote so, he could have been, you know, if he hadn't have been a scientist and an inventor of so many scientific pursuits and interests, he still would have been in the Hall of Fame, because he was such a great poet. And Pale Blue Dot, I think, really sums up the gift of science, letting us look at our true circumstances in the cosmos and realizing that we have to be much kinder, more generous with each other, because this is the only home that we have.
I wonder what he would have said had he been around whenever we finally do send astronauts to Mars. And
he would have been so thrilled, because even though he really was a proponent of robotic exploration, because he, you know, it's cheaper and the cost of human life is eliminated, he was for a human mission to Mars, because he felt that this would be the best possible use of our testosterone. You know, instead of constantly building up more weapons of mass destruction, the idea of using our science and high technology to explore the cosmos and to go to new horizons and new frontiers, that was really the best use of these machines. So he would have loved it.
David, Great Falls, Montana, west of the Rockies. You're up with us, David. Go ahead.
Well, it's an honor to ask my question. What do you think that Carl would say is the key for humans to be able to cooperate, Bible machine, something like genes have been able to do?
Well, I think education is the best means that we have possible. I think Carl, I wouldn't want to speak for him, but I think that's what he believed, that. And that's why he was so passionate about communicating science, because he felt that the more people who had this planetary or cosmic perspective, the harder it would be to manipulate them. He knew that all governments lie, and he felt very strongly that if we all had a baloney detection kit, in other words, the methodology of science in our heads, how much more difficult it would be to manipulate us. We'd know when we were being lied to, and if we knew that, we couldn't keep making the same mistakes over and over again. He was a huge proponent of public education available to everyone. And I think he would have been very sad about the state of our public schools, because he was a product of the public schools. He was a product of a working-class family that really lifted itself up, and he believed that was the absolute cornerstone of a democracy, the ability to get access to education.
And what do you think was the most perplexing question that Carl just never got the answer for?
Oh, there were so many. I mean, the other thing about him was that he understood science was a form of humility, that, you know, that our ignorance is so much greater than what we know with our fledgling science that we've only really been at systematically for, what, 400 years? So he, while thinking that science was very powerful and being marveling at how far we've come in those 400 years from 1609, Galileo's first look through a telescope, and here, 2010, we have left the solar system. We are discovering extrasolar planets, new worlds, about one a month. And so he was amazed at the awesome power of science, but he knew how little we know. And the number of questions he had were virtually infinite.
Michael, what was it like for you to direct these videos? Did you have fun?
Oh, my gosh. I had a wonderful time. I felt like a kid in a candy store because, again, no restrictions. This is the thing that people don't realize about the Internet. Everybody can be their own producer, and we're seeing that with Facebook, and we're seeing that, of course, all around the world.
Sure.
But even a program such as yours, your show is just one aspect of a larger universe of information, your website, your podcasts, your old programs. Radio could never be like that in the old days, and it's going to be more of that. And I think we're going to see more and more special productions unrestricted by the costs and the commercial considerations of theaters and motion pictures and network television happening on the Internet. So not only was I doing a subject and directing and producing a subject that I love and I think is important, but again, as a media practitioner, I really feel that we're on the cutting edge, that we're on the frontier of a whole new era. And that's as exciting to me as the astronomy.
Let's see if we can squeeze in John in Stanford, Connecticut, east of the Rockies. John, good morning.
Good morning, George. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
And I would just like to tell you that in 1992, I got this Volkswagen bus, and inside that bus was a book called A Brief Time in History. And it was written by, I believe your husband.
It was written by Stephen Hawking, but my husband mm-hmm. wrote the introduction.
He helped him write that book. And that book changed my life. I wanted to know so much more because I had no idea what a black hole was at that time. I didn't even. And from there on in, my life has just changed. I am so spiritual now, and I'm a little disappointed with the History Channel because they don't show enough of Carl's work.
Thank you so much.
You know.
Yeah. In fact, actually, I'm really glad you brought that up. And of course, the great Stephen Hawking is still with us in Cambridge, and he is. And yes, Carl did write the introduction for that book, which. With Cosmos, they are the two most popular works of science ever published in any language.
Well, we were blessed to have him for this brief moment on this planet, Anne.
That's what I think.
Absolutely. And Michael, I've got to get you back to do a program on just the craze of talk radio and talk television. We've got to do that one day.
Anytime. I'd love to do it. It has been such a pleasure being with you, George, and telling the people that listen to this program are the kind of people we think would enjoy our project. We work very hard on it, and I'm so grateful for you spreading the word about it.
Podjockey.com is the website, right?
Yes, indeed.
All right, thank you. That's Michael Harrison and, of course, Andrian, the wife of the late Carl Sagan, who was the best astronomer out there. Who just brought it all home and just made it personal, made science fun, made looking into the heavens exciting. I'll be back in a moment with Open Lines right here on Coast to Coast AM. Don't go away.